These are the true stories of farmers, conservationists, sustainable ag advocates, and researchers dedicated to advancing public policies to achieve a sustainable farming and food system in the United States. Find out what happens when people take action and start caring for the land.
Today's February 11th, 2016. This is Ron Cruz talking, and today I have the privilege of interviewing Bob Gray, who is the representative for the National Center for Appropriate Technology and also represents other interests, including dairy farmers in New York, who as I've known for many years as an advocate for sustainable agriculture and conservation. We're in Washington, D.C. at the Mott House, 122 Maryland. So Bob, thank you for doing this today. Really glad to have you here. I'd like to start these interviews out really with what got folks interested in agriculture in the first place, and how come you've ultimately ended up devoting most of your career to agriculture in one way or another, particularly sustainable agriculture and conservation. So take me through your biography.
Well, I grew up on a dairy farm in upstate New York, in Cayuga County, which is southwest of Oswego, New York. And on a farm that we had about 50 head of dairy cows. And I went to the ag school at Cornell. And what got me interested really in conservation was working the land. For some reason, when you were plowing and turning the soil over, of course, we try to avoid as much of that now as we can today. But there's just something, I had this feel for the land. And I think many people who are in farming growing up get that feeling. So as I went to college and I started working in the field of agriculture primarily all of my life, mm-hmm. I've always had a deep interest in improving the soil, protecting the land, and doing things that would make sure that you were not harming it. But you know, those are the kind of things you remember as you were growing up and farming with my dad. Until I went to Cornell, and then I would come back and help and during the summers and so forth. And then my brother farmed with my father for a while. Our farm, which was near Lake Ontario, was taken for a nuclear power plant siting by eminent domain. Wow. Back in the early 70s. They never built the plant. They took the land. We had 250 acres. They took about 3,000 acres. It was mainly dairy farms. And you could see why they went after that, because there was a fair amount of acreage you could get that amount of land accumulated pretty quickly by eminent domain. Rochester Gas and Electric, and of course, out of Rochester, wanted to build a nuclear plant. And eminent domain was the way these power commissions got the land. My father fought it for a little bit, but you can't win on eminent domain. Long story short, in 1979, they were getting ready to commission it. 3 Mile Island occurred. The plant was never built. The land sat there for, oh my gosh, over 30 years. It was purchased for over $10 million and I can tell you, nobody got rich because they paid really ag prices. This was not an area where there was urban development or urban pressures on the land. But They paid that much out to the landholders, and then the town bought it 30 some years later for $2 million. But they subdivided that land into 16 acre parcels, and some of it is being developed now into these ranchette kind of things out on the farm. So that was my experience, and then I went to Cornell. In the 60s, I was in the Army for 2 years with the 1st Infantry Division in Fort Riley, Kansas. When I got out of the Army, I taught ag, high school level, including in Cato Meridian High School, Weedsport, and Port Byron. They had what they called the Board of Cooperative Educational Services, where they shared teachers between three schools. And there was a group of us who taught different ag subjects. And I worked with the FFA. I had a young farmer program in which I brought young farmers in. So then I went from there to work for the county planning office, because there was a lot of planning going on at that time, land use planning as well as other resources. And I found that very interesting. I was always fascinated by land use issues. And I went to work for the Cayuga County Planning Board as a senior planner for 3 years. And then I was over in Vermont visiting a friend I'd been in the Army with, and I didn't see much possibility there for promotion in the future. And so he said, well, why don't you go to work? Why don't you look into the state of Vermont? And I said, well, you know, gee, what would I be eligible for? What would I be qualified for? But anyways, I went down on a Friday afternoon in jeans and a T-shirt. I met with the head of the person who was head of personnel, and she said, well, the attorney general is looking for a person who's had planning experience. So I went over to the office, and I wanted to make an appointment with him on Monday. And his secretary said, well, he's in this afternoon. I said, well, I mean, that's all right. Anyways, I spent an hour and a half with Jim Jeffords, who was attorney general in Vermont. He hired me. I became his budget director and planner for the Vermont Attorney General's office. And that's how I got to D.C. Because Jim was elected to Congress in 1974. He started in Congress in 75. He was on the Ag Committee. That's always been a big deal. Vermont agriculture is extremely important. Senator Leahy's on the Ag Committee. They've always had a number. Aiken was on for years when he was a senator in Vermont. And Jeffords knew I had an ag background. And as a freshman Republican, believe it or not, he got a staff slot on the committee. And in May of 1975, he hired me. And that's how I got started down in this area.
I'd never heard that story.
Yeah. So that's what got me going. And we worked on a lot of issues. And that was where we thought that we should do something about farmland protection. Because the USDA had a study that had come out, the National Resources Inventory, the NRI, which showed considerable urban development and pressures on farmland around our major urban areas. And a lot of very good land. And so Jeffords introduced a bill, and but he was very close friends with Bob Berglund, then the Secretary of Agriculture. Mr. Berglund said, why don't we do the study? Why don't USDA, and I'll get, he got 11 other federal agencies. He co-chaired it with the Council on Environmental Quality, and they hired me to be the executive director of that study. And so I took over doing that. I was with Jeffords for 4 years, from 75 to 79. In June of 79, I became the executive director of the National Agricultural Land Study. But let me just drop back a minute. When I was working on ag issues in the Farm Bill and the Ag Committee, I was interested not only in farmland protection, realizing that that's not a federal issue per se, because it's a local land use issues, but the federal government can help with the state and local governments. But I was also interested in sustainable farming conservation. And somebody said to me, have you ever met Ferd Hefner? And I said, no. They said, well, he's right over in the Methodist building. So he was one of the first people I met actually in the summer of 75. Yeah. So I've known Ferd that long. And Ferd is really the high priest of sustainable ag. There isn't anybody that I could think of that would tower over Ferd. He does it. He goes about his business. He doesn't make a lot of noise, but he's very effective. Great. So anyways, in 79, I became executive director of the National Ag Land Study. It went on for 2 years. We had a lot of fights with some of the economists at USDA about the severity of this and the impact it would have on the availability of food supply in the future. Their argument always was that we will have new technology, we'll have increase in crop yields, and therefore that would offset any loss that we would have in farmland. But and the data was more sketchy because you didn't have global positioning and all of that kind of satellite information that they have today. They used county maps to do the NRI and make estimates of how much land was lost, and they were always poking holes, the economists were in this. But Mr. Berglund and his chief economist, Howard Yort, who was a very tough guy. I mean, Howard was, give me the facts. But he looked at this and he said, it doesn't make sense for us, prudence wise, to lose 1 million acres a year. There was a 3 million acre figure. But of that, 1 million acres was prime ag land. And he said, that makes no sense at all for the U.S. to lose that kind of land because it's irreplaceable. And so, you know, Will Rogers would say, hang on to your prime farmland. They're not making it anymore. So anyways, we fought our way through that study and got that done in 1981. And it did raise awareness of the issue around the country. And we did a book that we evaluated all the farmland protection programs, including agricultural districts, right to farm laws, ag zoning, transfer development rights, purchase of development rights. We did a complete assessment and how they were working and what changes might need to be made. In addition to that, we did a report on the general overview of the impact of loss of farmland to urban uses. So that came out in 81, right when the Reagan administration was in place. Fortunately, in changing administrations, I had an informal advisory committee, and John Block, who was the director or commissioner of ag in Illinois, who became Secretary of Agriculture, was on that advisory committee that I had. So he understood, and he was very supportive. So, you know, they started to do things internally at USDA to give states more technical assistance to use their, at that time, the Soil Conservation Service to help local and county governments assess their farmland based upon the soil surveys and that kind of thing. So,
well, at that time, too, it came out, I remember, the severity of the soil loss issue,
right.
Not just the farmland loss, but the erosion problem.
That's right. This all came together sort of at the same time, from the mid-70s and the 80s, because the NRI had showed we were losing substantial amount of soil. And part of it was based upon the fence row to fence row plowing of grasslands in the Great Plains, as a result, going way back to the sale of wheat to Russia in the 70s. And at that time, farmers were encouraged to put in as much wheat. We, you know, you're gonna see prices go through the roof, and they were doing that. That land was not suitable to be plowed up. There was a lot of wind erosion and sheet and rill erosion. And there was generally more corn and soybeans being grown. So overall, even in the Corn Belt, there was a higher amount of erosion. So farmland protection, soil erosion, the interest in sustainable ag, doing more to get sustainable farming practices on farmland all sort of came together at that time. That's right.
That's good. Yeah, because that was when I was involved in starting the Land Stewardship Project. And I just remember, you know, a lot of the motivation was the idea of elevating the stewardship ideal to confront this issue of the way we were treating our land, and that we'd forgotten that we went through this in the Dust Bowl already.
That's right.
Only 40 years before or so, hardly that.
Yeah.
And yet we were doing those same things again. So that was a big part of it.
Yeah, and farmers were, you know, irritated with the federal government on things. Let me tell you an example. I've talked with a farmer on Washington State where they'd put power lines through farmland where they could have gone around it. They could have gone on the edge out in the Yakima Valley. And this farmer said to me, the Public Power Commission said, well, I'm not going to let any damn farmer tell me where to put power lines. And it just, you could go under those power lines at night and you could hold up fluorescent lights and they would light up.
Yeah.
And insects wouldn't be under those, you know. Yeah. And so those were the kind of things we thought the federal government could do. In fact, Bob Berglund once said to me, they brought me out for this Farmers Home Administration was putting this new sewer line in, dedicating it. And he said, I went out there, I forgot what state it was in, but he said they were going through like 200 acres of prime farmland where the federal government was paying for sewer lines and all this land was going to be converted. So he said, we shouldn't be doing that. We're part of the problem. We're not going to control local land use. So all of this is moving forward. The soil conservation and the farmland preservation issues sort of culminated in 85 Farm Bill. And I'm probably the most proud of all the work that I have done was in 1985, because we got the Soil Conservation Reserve, we got the Sodbuster Bill, and we got Sustainable Ag authorized in the Farm Bill.
Right.
And it was a tough fight, but we, in fact, I used Howard Yort's firm I was working for, I went to work for the American Farmland Trust.
Yeah, which started Jeffords at some time in there.
Yeah. After the National Ag Land Study was over in 1981, I became Director of Policy Development for the American Farmland Trust, a private nonprofit organization dedicated to preserving farmland, both from policy matters as well as taking easements on land as well. So I was working with them up through the 85 Farm Bill, and we got these provisions in which were major, major changes in my view, because we never had a program, for example, a conservation reserve where you would rent land or get it out of production, put it into grass or trees. And the goal was 35, 40 million acres. And you know who, I'll never forget, I was testifying because I would go to almost every hearing I could get on the Hill and push the idea of the conservation reserve. And I was testifying before the senator from Indiana, Senator, Lugar. And Lugar I started to testify and I was giving some facts and figures, and he's looking through the testimony and he said, Mr. Gray, would you hold for a minute? He said, I don't seem to have your testimony. And so the staff all jumped up and about four copies were stuck in his face. I have it now, he said. But anyways, about 3 weeks after that hearing, he introduced a conservation reserve bill in Indiana. And he had the Secretary of Ag out there, and that was a huge help because then it became really bipartisan. Lugar was highly thought of, and you know, he's on the Ag Committee and a big Ag state. So, and I worked with many other conservation organizations. We actually had a conservation coalition, but we had the Audubon, Sierra Club, the Conservation Foundation, Wildlife Fund, all of those groups would participate with us, and we would talk about strategy for getting this done. I would have to say, looking back over the last several years, that this was something I feel a great accomplishment to get that much done in a farm bill, to move this issue beyond just trying to fund USDA's the conservation money for conservation practices. We always had a big fight on that. It wasn't a lot of money, but this was a big outlay. Right. And it really started. And you know, this started, the idea from the Conservation Reserve Program came from farmers in, my understanding is, in Colorado, wheat farmers, because that was where they'd been plowing up a lot of land, particularly on the Front Range. Yeah. And so Senator, I think it was Armstrong, was from Colorado. But anyways, he was visiting with a bunch of wheat farmers. And he said, well, I don't want to regulate, you know, this is more federal regulation. What do you guys think? So one farmer stood up and said, you know what you should do? If you want to plow up this land, go ahead and do it. But you won't be eligible for federal farm programs. Go ahead and do it. Nobody's going to stop you. No federal agent's going to come out and say you can't do it. And that caught on because, in other words, if you're gonna not plow up that land, then you're gonna be eligible. And it was a good idea. And we were able to fight our way through that and get this passed.
Yeah, and that was at that time called cross compliance, I remember, and that's now called conservation
compliance. Yeah. Yeah. Cross compliance seemed to get sort of a negative connotation, and you know, so then from there we went on to other programs in the 90s, all the way through up to now. And, you know, including the organic program was established in the 90 Farm Bill, and we had the SARE program, which is great. We were always fighting for more research and technical assistance to help farmers. And the conservation program, or the Conservation Reserve Program, got going full bore. And then over the years, a lot of add-ons, including the Wetlands Reserve Program, the Farmland Preservation Program, the Grasslands Reserve Programs. They've all been consolidated now in the last few years, but they were all aimed at getting that land out of production. Now, in this case, these programs were permanently put them out of production, where the CRP was a 10-year deal, but it still was effective, and it the next NRI showed that there was a reduction after this program, or well, it was a couple more NRIs after that. I remember going out to Minnesota and going on a farm that had around 175 acres or so in the CRP. It was all in a beautiful grass. Yeah. And it was just nice to see that. The guy was growing hay on it. It was very rolling, steep land. Right. And he put it in the CRP for 10 years. Yeah. And he was happy with it because he was developing another market for the sale of hay.
Right.
But and then there was always arguments about, you know, using the CRP when there were droughts and so forth. But generally, if that land is in grass or trees, not much of it went into trees, but if it's in grass, it's going to be okay as long as it isn't plowed up.
Right.
That was
right.
The thing.
So, and that program, that's not to go much further with this, but that program came under stress with the big increase in corn prices
right.
back about 3 or 4 years ago, and
right.
some of that land,
yeah.
when they could retire after the contract was up, I'm afraid right. went back into production.
Exactly.
And then we kind of repeated this cycle that
yeah.
overproduction, the price goes down, and
right. Right.
there'll probably be more pressure to put the back in. The
yeah. I mean, now you're looking at corn at $3.70 a bushel, where you're up to almost $8 a bushel.
Right.
And that puts huge stress on these conservation lands because they want to use them.
Right.
They want to
exactly.
get in there. And so as we moved forward from the 90s, we kept getting additional programs, the EQIP program that's very much geared for environmental quality incentives program, then the conservation security program going all the way up through to the conservation stewardship program.
Right.
And these have all just been add-ons. And during that whole time, FERD just was quietly getting more and more sustainable ag programs work, the beginning farmer program and others, and he would incorporate provisions into various ongoing USDA programs that would include emphasis on sustainable ag. That's a real key,
right.
because some of these things were not allowed by USDA by regulation, so we had to change them. And FERD was just doing that on many, many fronts
right.
during that time period.
And he was drawing on the strength coming from the farmers that were part of regional groups like the Practical Farmers of Iowa
right.
or the
right.
Land Stewardship Project
yeah.
and the various yeah. groups that were.
Yeah.
So it was always one of the things Ferd is proud of himself is how we're always ground truthing all these ideas, either getting from farmers or checking back in to make sure they would work on the farm.
Yeah, and I would have to say this, in addition to Ferd's work at the federal level, the Land Stewardship Project and programs like that at the state level would build the grassroots support, and that's what you needed. It was tough to really, at any federal level, to get any organization to get things done unless, well, what about my state? What's going on in Minnesota? What's going on in Iowa? What about Missouri? And you had us, I mean, you were one of the first. I was privileged to be on the board of directors of your Land Stewardship Project, but that was a huge help. That combined with what FERD was doing gave him the political leverage
right.
to get these things done.
Exactly.
So
we've taken up, that's been really good. And now in your personal career, you then pretty soon just hung out a shingle as a consultant. Had
yeah,
you?
I did.
When
yeah.
did that take place?
That took place in 1985. I had worked, I'd done the National Agon Study after I left Jeffords' office from 1979 to 81. Then I worked for the American Farmland Trust for 4 years. And I sort of decided that if I was going to do this, now is the time to do it because I had some name recognition out there among conservation organizations. And so I hung out my own shingle and set up my own firm. It became known eventually as Bob Gray LLC. It was a limited liability company. And initially, excuse me, I did a lot of work for different conservation organizations. For example, I did a survey in Colorado of wheat farmers in terms of using the Conservation Reserve Program. I did a tremendous amount of work in Minnesota. I probably did more work in Minnesota than any other state. On farmland preservation, I even did an evaluation on the airport they were going to build next to the Twin Cities. Yeah, yeah. And I'll never forget the guy said, boy, this is a good report, although this architectural firm and engineering firm, they wanted the contract to do all the work. They were not terribly happy with my summary that said, if you put a new 6-lane or whatever lane highway out in Dakota County and start building hotels, you think you're not going to convert farmland? All of that land is going to fall under pressure. Well, anyways, that airport was, that extension was never built. I think it's Dakota Heights is where the right in that area is where the airport is right now.
Yeah.
But as we moved on, we just kept getting more things tacked on, and that was always the game plan. as we moved in through the subsequent farm bills. Now, 85, going back to ATRA, in the 1985 farm bill, there was some language put in there because we had been talking about getting information to farmers on sustainable farming practices. And so there was language in the farm bill that said that information of that nature should be provided to farmers as to how to improve practices that would help the soil, reduce pollution, and so forth. And so Peggy Miller, who worked with the National Center for Appropriate Technology, she lobbied to get money to set up ATRA, which is the Appropriate Technology Transfer for Rural Programs area. It's under the National Center for Appropriate Technology, which is a private nonprofit organization. And in the fiscal 1987 appropriations bill, she got $500,000 to get it started. And that's when they hired me because she knew I had an ag background. And of course, she was full-time staff at that time with NCAT to help get the staff recruited, get them and start the program up. And we opened our doors to start to take phone calls on our 800 line on June 1st, 1987. We were in Memphis and Shelby County. And that's when we opened our doors. And, you know, it's been growing ever since. But I'm very, very proud to be associated. I've been associated with it right from the very beginning.
And I'd like to, you know, I was privy to some of this because
I worked for you.
became the head of the National Center for Appropriate Technology for NCAT. And it had already been through several struggles, but I think it'd be interesting to talk for 5 minutes a little bit about just what an effort it has taken to keep that program going, because as you've referred to, not everybody within the bureaucracy of USDA necessarily likes some of those programs.
No, they did not.
And
it was the same way with the National Agilon Study, although that wasn't a program, it was just a study. Right. But there were a lot of the economists in the Economic Research Service, so that's a waste of time. Right. You know, I don't care how much land we lose, we'll have new fertilizers, new, you know, improved crops will increase yields. Well, when ATRA got funded in fiscal year 87, it sort of got off on the wrong foot. It wasn't intended to be that way, but the $500,000 was added to the extension budget. And the Extension Service here in Washington said, we would have got that money. This is money that's going to a private nonprofit. It's taken out of it was an add-on. It wasn't taken out of their budget. Okay. But they did everything they could to badmouth it over the years. And now, which is so interesting, is the valuations we've done. Who recommends farmers to use ATRA? Extension Service agents at the county level are one of the highest because these guys are overworked and stressed out. And this is one-stop shopping for sustainable ag. So that was our first hurdle to get through that, which was not easy because they had the long knives out to kill the appropriations for the next few years. Then we did not like it, particularly in Shelby County, where we were at the Agri Center, because of the facilities wasn't all that good for us in terms of our staff. We had a staff of 11. That's what we started with. And so we talked to Senator Bumpers in Arkansas, who is very active, obviously, in ag issues. And he said, why don't you come over to Fayetteville, the University of Arkansas, because that made a lot of sense. And we'd be affiliated, not in any official way, but we'd be close to university. We'd have the results of that research. It would connect us with other land-grant universities. Right. And it was a great place to get new staff.
Right.
So we rented some facilities from University of Arkansas. And in 1989, we moved over there. Well, somebody was very unhappy, obviously, that they lost a tenant at the Agri Center in Memphis. In Shelby County, which is the county around Memphis. But anyways, they went to Congressman Whitten, who chaired the Appropriations Committee for 40 years. Yeah. And he also chaired the Ag Appropriations. That was his specialty, but he chaired the overall committee. Well, he zeroed us out in 1989. But Senator Bumpers, I will never forget this, because I talked to his staff guy, Chuck Culver, probably 3 to 4 times a day. Yeah. And Senator Bumpers, very, very savvy guy, politically. He knew what he was going to do. And so what he did, we got transferred to the Interior Department, to their extension provision that they had to get us out of from under Jamie Whitten. And I'll never forget, there was a vote because Whitten wanted this resolved. And he said, I'll give the ATRA folks 60 days to shut the office down. And Bumper says, no. He said, I asked that we adjourn the meeting. And because the co-chair of Bumper's wasn't chairing that, I forgot it was a senator from North Dakota. But anyways, so they took a vote. And Bumper's voted by proxy with all the other members of the committee to adjourn the meeting. And that gave him time to go to Interior and work it out so we could be transferred over there. But I asked his staff guy, I said, God, I'm glad he had all those proxies. He said he didn't have any of them, but he could have got them. He was bluffing. Oh, that's interesting. I will never, again, that's one of those stories that you won't forget. I don't know if you want to put this on, but it was, Bumpers is very, he was so helpful to us. And we got over there, and then we, you know, the program started to grow. We started to get more money over the years. We now get 2.5 million. Our second crisis, I'll just go through the crisis after that in 89, which we actually, Bumpers shut down the appropriations, Ag Appropriations Conference Committee for 6 weeks in order to get this resolved in the fall of 89. Then he got us over to Interior. And so that was it. We got us out of the way of Congressman Whitten, and we survived. We got a little cut in our appropriations, but then we worked out very, Interior was very good, but we were sort of like to some degree, a square peg in a round hole. I mean, it was, they let us do what we were doing with farmers, and we did some work with their, with the refuges as well, because some of those refuges rent farmland to farmers. Right. And so we were doing sustainable farming, which was really necessary on refuges of ducks and geese and everything else that they have on the refuges. So that worked out okay. But then we got back into USDA, and we went to rural development, and that was during the Clinton administration. We decided that was the time to make the move. And so we went in there, and the reason we went to rural development rather than back to extension, because we'd had a little bit, difficulty, but not some other agency, was that a lot of the things that they were doing in rural development worked with cooperatives. They had rural business cooperative service, and so it was very active with farming organizations, and it made sense. And so that's what we did. We were transferred back over there. And so then we started to do work on farm energy, value-added products. Now they have a value-added grant program. It's very good, as well as sustainable farming practice.
And SAC played quite a role in that value-added with the Center for Rural Affairs.
That's right. I should have mentioned the Center for Rural Affairs. That's enough. I mean, all of this, your land stewardship project and all these others were working with FERC. I mean, it worked with me, but Ferd was really sort of coordinating that, all of that. Then coming forward to now, just mentioning, in 2015, we had 1.8 million contacts with farmers around the country through the ATRA program. And that includes them going up to our website and downloading our 450 publications, contacting our office either through the 800 toll line. Less of them use that now, because except the older farmers who aren't that conversant with computers, but most of the stuff comes in on email now. Somebody will send a question in, I've got this particular insect or this problem. And if we have a publication that will give them guidance, we'll start out. But if it's a very specific, very technical question, we have to get back to the person, get all the information on their farm, and then write up a very separate, detailed memo back to them as how to deal with it. But then we do workshops around the country, all over the country, and we get thousands of farmers that way. So those are sort of the three legs of the stool. And most recently, we have a program that I'm very fond of. We started a program to help returning veterans, military veterans, who want to get into farming. It's called Arm to Farm. And we've had over 700 veterans that we have trained. Now we're doing it week long, and we just evaluated it We got hold of about 100 of those farmers that are those veterans who've taken the program. And what makes me feel so good that 80% are actively in agriculture now. Now, you can't bring somebody into this program who just woke up some morning, you know yourself, and saying, I want to get into farming. You got to know what you're doing. So if you've had some background, had some interest, had some connection, we have to screen the people we bring in. We get about 100 applicants. We take about 30 in each of these week-long training sessions. Oh. But this is, and this is, has strong bipartisan support.
Yeah, that's true. And is that, that's in the ATRA budget now?
It's in the, well, here's what's not in the ATRA budget. Yes, the staff provides all of the training. So that's all done in kind. All the materials. Now, they bring in USDA people and university people as well, and they go out to farms. Part of it is in the class. Part of it is going out on successful commercial farms, whether it's organic or whether it's conventional or whatever. But we have to pay for all of their lodging, travel, and food for the week. It's not fair to ask them to pay for that. And so what we've done, we've asked for a little bit more money for fiscal year 2017, another $250,000. We're asking for $2.75 million, and we would use that $250,000 to do more of these and to pay for the travel, lodging, and food for the veterans.
I had one last question about ATRA. Haven't in the last couple of years or last few years, the funding stabilized or moved into the mandatory category?
It is not. You raise a very good point. What happened was this. We had always said we were authorized. This was one of our big crises. Yeah. This might have been, I don't know how this compares with Whitten, but we could have been wiped out on this one. There was this big issue about earmarks. And so it came up that ATRA was clearly an earmark. I mean, you know, there's no, you can look at the language in the 85 Farm Bill, but it's very general. So in the 2008 Farm Bill, we put in authorizing language. We didn't direct it to NCAT at all because you can't do that. But we said a private nonprofit would operate this program, and we listed all of the issues that ATRA would deal with. And they would have a cooperative agreement with USDA to do this. USDA has been very happy, the Rural Business Cooperative Service, to have NCAT run the program for them. Their overhead is very low. We've had five administrations of which we've had excellent working relationships with. But I tell you, we came a couple times this close to getting knocked out as an earmark. I spent a couple hours with staff on the Appropriations Committee on arguing about it. The argument that finally came through was that we were providing info to all 50 states. This was not some special little project that we had in Arkansas or some other state. It was national.
Right, right.
And people said, well, you know, but Bob, you're going to have to get this really authorized. If you don't get it authorized, it's very tough. So it's authorized. We still have to go back every year, though, and make our case.
So it's authorized, and that's clear, but what isn't clear is whether how much money gets
paid. That's right. That's right. And we have to go in and make the ask every year. That's correct.
And you're still doing that, right?
We're still doing that. So that was one. And the other crisis that came between the one in 89 and the earmark crisis was one where we did, in one time, run across an official down at USDA and Rural Business Cooperative Service, who wasn't all that friendly to us. We had a meeting with him, and he had tried to go up on the website, and for some reason, the website was down at that time. I mean, that happens. But he was very irritated by it. But anyways, he went to one of his staff people, and he said, I want to bid this program on. I want to get rid of NCAT. Well, the staff guy, who we work closely with, told him quite frankly that you can't do it that easily. And anyways, we bought some time, and we were able to get help from the Hill to say, look, they're doing a good job. Why do you want to do that? So we got rid of that. That I wouldn't put that. It's part of the three crises. I would say the earmark and the zeroing of our budget in 89 were the two big ones. Okay. Because we came very close to the earmark, and we got cut. That was the thing. We were up to $2.8 million. At that time, we got cut back to $2 million. But we remained in place, and we even had people volunteer to do work, and we're not paid. That's how much the people like that program. And we have, you know, people who have master's degrees, PhDs, people who've been into farming. Some of our staff are in the part-time farming while they're working for ATRA.
Right.
So, and we're all over the country now. We have offices in California, besides Montana, the home office, Arkansas, Mississippi, Texas, Pennsylvania. So we are, we put up regional offices because the difference in agriculture in the regions gives us a core staff of three or four people who can really zero in on what's important, whether it's dairy, whether it's whatever the crops are.
And of course, practically, that also makes it more appealing when it comes to be funded too.
That's right.
Look at it as a national program. Well, that's been very, very helpful. Good information. And I wanted to also have you talk a little bit more about your other work you've done as a lobbyist working here in Washington. I know that dairy industry's been a big part.
Yeah. Well, when I started out, as I mentioned, in 85, when I incorporated my business and hung out my shingle, I was doing individual projects. And that got to be difficult after a while because a project has a finite time frame. Somebody would hire you to do something for 6 months or you do a survey. And I was just constantly, it was like painting houses. I was always looking for the next house to paint. Yeah. And so I got a little tired of that. Right. I had ATRA, NCAT was stable through all that period because I had them on a year-to-year. I'm still on a year-to-year. If they don't like what I'm doing, they can get rid of me. But they obviously have been happy with what I've done, and I love to work for them. And anyways, about 1990, I had the chance to work with four dairy co-ops in the Northeast because a guy who'd been executive director of working for these co-ops and representing them in Washington took the job of the head of the Holstein Association. So I went to the co-op directors because I knew I'd kept my hand a little bit in dairy, coming from a dairy farm. I knew a lot of these guys. So I went to them and they hired me in 1990 to become a senior policy advisor. For now, it's called the Northeast Dairy Farmers Cooperatives. And it represents five co-ops, about 7,500 dairy farmers from Maryland to Maine that are part of dairy co-ops. They're members of dairy co-ops. And, you know, it's interesting. And I'll tell you one thing that the dairy businesses, this is true in most all the other ag areas, but they are doing a lot more sustainable work. That is where I have found that has been very pleasing to me, that they have picked up on this mainly because of the amount of coverage it gets through the work that FERD and others, and they become aware of it. And their customers had said, you know, what are you doing sustainably, you know, for, and even things like this. The co-ops now set up a computer system where their trucks make sure that they don't retrace their route. So their trucks pick up a milk at this farm, go to that. So they're saving energy, but they do all kinds of things like that. And, you know, I've enjoyed working with them, and it's a nice extra piece. Those are the two things that I've enjoyed very much. That's why I'm still working, because I like it. Even though people say, well, how do you get anything done in Washington? Well, you just have to keep pushing. We're going through one of those phases right now that is difficult in terms of expanding things and that kind of thing.
Well, I'd like to kind of wind this up with you looking at your long career and where you think things ought to go now. What do you think are like sort of the key issues for NSAC and its crew and even the ATRA program? Where is next places to go, both policy-wise in the short term and even longer term?
That's a good question, because for NCAT and the ATRA program, I just want to get the funding, more funding. And you know what happens here? The issues evolve, and you have to be on top of them and pick them up right away. For example, when organic started to be, we had the organic program, we started to get a lot more calls.
Right.
And from people on, I want to get certified. Oh, it's a very complicated process. You've got to take 3 years. And so, and we've done farm energy became an issue where we've had a lot of questions. The value added program, as we mentioned before, was put in, and that's used farmers markets. Right. All of those things, we have to constantly be looking at what's going on out there and where we can get our hand in to help in any way we can. In terms of agriculture in general, people may not agree with me, but I think it's headed in many ways. The commodity programs have always been a big issue, the cost of them. But I think moving to the insurance programs, even though there's some controversy with that, and they're voluntary, if you want to get into the insurance program, that's a better way to go than various support programs we had over the years. Let me tell you this example in dairy. We never had a support program. We always had the program that would buy excess product off the market and store it. But that wouldn't give any money back to a dairy farmer. But in 2002, we got the MILC program, the Milk Income Loss Contract Program. And that remained in place to 2014. It was targeted, capped for smaller farmers, 2.9 million pounds of milk a year. And so it worked very well. And when prices were down, they would get a subsidy from the federal government. But we've moved away from that. And in 2014 Farm Bill, we now have a insurance program called the MPP, the Market Protection Program, in which you can get a what is called, you can buy insurance at a $4 margin level all the way up to $8. And what that means is this. It's based upon your feed costs. And if your feed cost goes below a certain level in terms of your overall cost on farm, you will get an insurance premium payment back. At $4, all you do is pay in $100. But if the margin goes down to $4, I can tell you, you're going to be
$4 for 100 weight.
Yes, for 100 weight. Yeah. We've advised most farmers to buy between $6 and $6.50 in that range, because that will protect them if there's low prices. And right now prices are low. The problem is last year was the first year, and a fair amount of farmers, almost half, bought up some insurance above the $4 level. They bought in the $6-$6.50 range. However, the way the formula was calculated for feed costs, most of them didn't get any payment. So they might have laid out $8,000 or $10,000 or $15,000, and they don't like to do that. They thought they should get something back. There's a mindset about support vis-a-vis insurance. But I see this as positive in the ag industry without getting into all these. I mean, there was so much criticism of these other support programs, and some people could get two or three different programs. Whether they had a loss or not, they would still get money. And we're moving away from that, which I think is a good thing. The crop insurance program itself has some warts on it, but I think it's a better way to go. But when you look at the budget, I just did a story for my dairy farmers on USDA's budget, $151 billion. 16% goes to the commodity programs. 4% of the budget, of the $4.1 trillion president's budget, it goes to ag. About 0.2% goes into the commodity program. So it's not exactly, if we wipe those out completely, would it give us a big, so I think generally speaking, as flawed as many of them were over the years, the commodity programs have probably at least helped to stabilize our agriculture in this country. Certainly not perfect, but they've been helpful. But I think now with the insurance and the way they're being structured, it's headed in the right direction.
I think that one of the things that I'm seeing on the horizon, and I think NSAC is one of the groups working on this, is to bring something of that conservation compliance idea to the insurance.
Yes.
Too.
Yes.
That if you are going to get subsidized by tax dollars,
yes,
by taxpayers, maybe half of your insurance costs, really, up to that, then you should at least have some conservation on your land as a quid pro quo.
Yeah. And that there has been a lot of opposition to that. We were able to get it in the 85 Farm Bill, which was amazing. But it was because, as people thought about that, even people who were very pro, their corn or soybean or what, they say, well, you know what? If you're going to plow up land that shouldn't be plowed up, then go ahead and do it. We're not sending somebody out to stop you. But you're not going to be eligible for the program. It seemed to make sense. Now it's a little more, these guys, we got to have this crop insurance. And if we don't get it, and now we have to do all this conservation. I think eventually we're going to get that, eventually. But that's right. So.
Well, I think we've covered almost everything that was in my notes and about the policy work wins you helped achieve and your ongoing work. I don't know if you have any further thing. If not, we can wrap it up. Or
no, I just find that I'm very satisfied with the work I've done over the years. I feel that I've had a small part in a big picture, and with the Agland study, with the work I did on the Conservation Reserve Program, with ATRA, and all of those working on sustainable ag in general, I feel that I've helped to make a contribution, and that's very satisfying, that I've been part of a bigger picture But it just makes me feel good. And that's why I'm still working, because I like what I'm doing.
That's great. Thank you very much for your contribution and this interview today.
I appreciate it.
This has been part of the National Sustainable Agriculture Oral History Archive, produced by Ron Cruz, available on the Minnesota Institute for Sustainable Agriculture website. The podcast was made possible by the Center for Rural Affairs.